Lowe's knows how to help you save this 4th of July. Upgrade your laundry routine with the new and exclusive first-of-its-kind all-in-one vented laundry combo. Wash and dry in just 68 minutes. Save up to 40% on select major appliances. Plus, when you buy more, you save more. Shop Samsung this July 4th at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
I'm Todd McComas.
And I'm Jessica Knoll. And we are
the Investigators.
Try to catch me howling at the moon.
Welcome back to all our partners in crime. We hope you had a crime-free week. And if you did not, we hope that everyone is okay and that you have the right investigators on the case.
And if you don't, reach out to us. That's what we're here for.
This is our Thanksgiving week episode, so happy Thanksgiving to all of you that celebrate it. Thanksgiving happens to be my favorite holiday of them all because it's the holiday where we are all empowered to put our diets aside and embrace self-indulgence as we stuff our fat, happy faces with all of our favorite home-cooked foods.
Well, I think Thanksgiving is actually a time to celebrate with family and friends and be thankful, but I enjoy the food as well. Pretty much anything with the word casserole in it that my mom makes, like corn casserole, broccoli casserole, green bean casserole, you know, they all have a veggie in them. So that means they're healthier, but not sweet potato casserole because you leave sweet potatoes alone. They don't need marshmallows. And my mom's legendary stuffing that I've somewhat learned how to master over the years. Hers is still way better, though.
Oh, and the ham, turkey, chicken and noodles, mac and cheese, pumpkin pie, pumpkin rolls, pumpkin cookies. Give me all of it until I slip off into a food coma on the couch in front of the TV during a shitty NFL matchup.
Well, most importantly, this is a holiday where we all congregate at grandma's or mom's and spend some much-needed time with family.
Great point. And on that note, because everyone knows most of us leave our homes on this particular day, please keep in mind that Thanksgiving is also a favorite holiday for burglars.
That's right. So please don't advertise on Facebook or Instagram that you'll be stuffing your face at someone else's house all day long. Because you don't want to make it obvious to would-be burglars that your house is easy pickings.
Keep your home secure. Make it a hard target for those looking to load up a van full of all your favorite shit.
But do it the right way, the safe way. Get an alarm system, a big dog, rent a car to park in your driveway, pose a family of mannequins in the kitchen.
That's all great advice and conveniently the perfect segue for this episode. So everyone scrape the mashed potatoes off your shovel because it's time to dig into this week's case. This case takes us to a small city that's known for being the childhood home of famed aviator Charles Lindbergh, a name forever tied to the most infamous kidnapping in history. This case takes us to Little Falls, Minnesota.
And more specifically, we're going to 14319 Elm Street in Little Falls, Minnesota, where a 5,000 square feet house sits on an 8-acre wooded lot. And on November 22nd, 2012, Thanksgiving Day, the lives of two local teenagers were tragically taken.
This is the story of the Elm Street murders.
Byron David Smith spent much of his adult life helping to ensure the security of American assets and the safety of American diplomats on foreign soil.
After serving as an officer in the Air Force, which included a tour in Vietnam, he served as a security engineer for the U.S. State Department. There, his primary responsibility was to design and install security measures for U.S. embassies to protect personnel and the integrity of confidential records and data from potential terrorist threats.
a career that meant he'd never enjoy the luxury of permanently planting roots in any one location that he could call home, and certainly not on U.S. soil where he was born and raised. He spent his lengthy career moving and setting up temporary residency in various locations across the globe.
Parts of the world that wouldn't necessarily be considered vacation destinations. Places where perceived threats to the American way of life are fostered. That isn't always the reason for posting a U.S. embassy in a particular part of the world, but many times that is the case.
Well, the primary purpose of an embassy is to assist Americans who travel to or live in the host country and to serve as headquarters for foreign service officers to carry out duties related to the advancement of U.S. interests in that part of the world.
And in many parts of the world, this U.S. presence and effort to advance our own interests is not welcome. So security is taken very seriously, and those who provide that security in any fashion are considered vital and extremely valued personnel. But only a small number of people who have proper security clearance and work in that field know who these people are and exactly what they do. They are, for all practical purposes, unsung heroes. And this is the case with most members of the special operations community.
And once these members retire from service and return home, the transition from being someone considered vital to the security of their nation to just another faceless person in a neighborhood can be pretty rough. It can have damaging psychological effects on a person. There's a sense of loss that can occur, a grieving for the death of the person they once were or for the life they once had, a self-perceived sense of worthlessness or a lack of recognition by those around them now can lead to depression and other mental health issues.
Living and working in an environment where a threat or even a perceived threat to your well-being constantly surrounds you can also take its own toll on you, especially if you live and work in such an environment for decades. Because in order to keep you safe, your brain keeps you in a constant state of vigilance. Then after 20 to 30 years of this, you retire and go home where it's far more safe and where you don't have to be in a state of vigilance 24/7. But good luck convincing your brain of that. So now you find yourself living a normal person's life, but in a constant state of what is known as hypervigilance.
And hypervigilance is a spectrum. So symptoms and effects range from mild to severe. And unfortunately, for some people suffering severe effects and don't get treated, they can experience extreme paranoia. And their mind can start trying to justify this constant feeling of impending danger by finding or inventing threats that aren't actually there.
Although we are not here to offer any excuses for Byron Smith's actions on this particular Thanksgiving Day, we do feel this information and understanding it is important for you as a listener so you can recognize it if you see these symptoms in someone you care about. And we do feel personally that it helps to answer some important questions in this particular tragedy.
When Byron Smith retired from his position with the State Department in 2009, he returned home to Little Falls, Minnesota. He moved into his family home with his mother, and he inherited the home after she passed. Byron was known as a loner, but he had managed to make one friend in the neighborhood, Bill Anderson.
According to Bill, Byron had hired some local kids to clean up his wooded property in the summer of 2012. Among these kids were teenagers Haley Kiefer and her cousin Nick Brady. Bill said he assumed this arrangement was going well as he learned that on more than one occasion, Byron cooked dinner for this group of hired helpers.
But then, on October 28, 2012, Bill said he visited Byron, and he barely recognized him. He said Byron told him he hadn't had a decent night's sleep in months and that his home had been broken into multiple times over the past several months, the most recent of which was the day before. Byron claimed that between cash he kept in his home and valuables that were stolen, he was out over $42,000. He was certain that 18-year-old Haley Kiefer and her 17-year-old cousin, Nick Brady, were to blame.
We're about to play you a clip from a statement given to police by Byron Smith after his arrest. You'll notice that his account from the previous break-ins differs from the account he gave to his friend Bill in that they go back much further in time. In fact, they go back before he had retired and moved back full time. He also claims that a different neighbor was to blame for many of these alleged break-ins.
So you've actually been having problems with people breaking into your house, is that correct?
The same people, the same pattern. It goes back a long time.
Okay. When did that start? When did it start where people
first time it happened was, I'm guessing, 12 to 15 years ago. And there was a sheriff's report on it when they broke into the garage and tore up a bunch of packing cases, threw glassware on the floor to break it, and stole a bunch of clothing.
Okay.
Now, I try to not be sexist, but when somebody steals clothing and ignores the tools, I tend to think it's a woman.
Okay. What kind of clothing did they take? You remember that time? Was it women's clothes or men's clothes? Something different?
Military clothes. You know, the kind of unisex stuff that... Sure. And not only that, but the following week, Ashley Williams was seen wearing my Flightline military jacket from the Air Force to school.
Okay. Ashley Williams?
Yeah.
And how do you know this Ashley Williams?
I've never met her.
Okay.
Except maybe now, and then it's not sure, but I've never met her.
Okay. But you heard that somebody saw her or saw her?
Bill has close relationship with schools because he does fundraising. And he asked, and this was reported to him.
Okay.
However, since it was gossip and rumor, it wasn't official evidence. Sure. And apparently she was not in full possession of her facilities because she dropped stuff all the way home that Bill collected the next morning.
From your house?
Yeah. Well, stuff that she had collected in her arms, and it was falling out of her arms on the way home.
So kind of a trail from where she had broken into?
That trail of dropped stolen stuff she was taking home.
Did that trail of broken or dropped stuff, was that in your yard at all?
Yeah, it was down the driveway.
Okay.
Leading towards their house.
So is Ashley Williams a neighbor of yours? Your guess's?
My closest neighbor.
Okay. So she lives, what, right next door?
At the end of my rather large yard.
Okay.
So, yes, they are my closest neighbor.
Okay. Do you know Ashley's parents at all?
I have tried very hard to avoid them. Okay. They're nasty people.
Okay. You've never gotten along with them?
I have avoided not getting along with them.
Mm. Okay.
They have misused and abused too many other people I know for me to have anything to do with them. I limit myself to being polite.
Okay.
You know, if I see them by the mailbox, I'll say good morning. Mm-hmm. I've never intentionally talked with them about anything. Except last year, the spruce in the neighborhood have a fungus disease. I went to the door and gave them a Xerox copy of how to identify it and how to treat it, just because getting rid of an infection in the neighborhood's a good thing. There was no social interaction. They took the paper and shut the door.
Okay. Okay.
But
and is Ashley, do you know, was she still currently living at home with her parents?
She's in and out a lot.
Okay. So you've seen her there recently?
I haven't seen her. I know what her car looks like.
Okay.
Because Bill pointed it out to me.
Okay.
Bill watches everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he pointed out her car, and I see it there occasionally.
Okay.
Occasionally meaning like several times a month, maybe a couple times a week.
So you've heard and suspect that Ashley Williams had been breaking into your place on different occasions. Is that correct to say?
Yes.
Okay. And now, in particular, you had an incident that happened just recently at your house, or break-in, mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah.
When did this happen?
That would be about 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
And the break-in occurred by kicking in the panel on the basement door.
Okay. Were you home at the time this happened?
No.
Okay. Do you know if this happened during the day or at night?
Very specifically. I left to go shopping at St. Cloud 11:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And when I came back at 6 o'clock, the place had been thoroughly gone through with the missing items as shown in the report.
Okay.
So I know for sure it happened exactly when I was gone. And it's right down to within, you know, 5 or 6 hours, which makes me suspect that it was someone who saw me come and go.
Okay. Did you call and report that incident?
I turned in a written report to Jamie asking him to investigate.
Okay.
I have not had confirmation that he investigated, but I assume he did.
Okay.
I would like to get a copy of that as also. There was also a tool bag stolen. It looks like she wanted the bag because there were tools left alongside the bag that weren't taken. But it was a nice bag.
So you suspect a female party stole it?
It's the same pattern all the way through.
Okay.
But that's a different story.
Yeah.
Unrelated.
So it's unclear how much time he spent at his mother's house while he was traveling abroad for his job with the State Department. But he tells the detective they've been experiencing burglaries at the home going back 12 to 15 years, and that his closest neighbor, Ashley Williams, who won't be mentioned in the story again, was responsible.
It's interesting that he's blaming these on a female. Now, he gives some clear examples of why he suspects a female, and Ashley specifically, but it's interesting because burglary is predominantly a male-dominated crime. But he's a single man and always has been, so maybe there's some kind of thing going on with his view of women. Maybe not. I'm sure his job wasn't exactly conducive to married life, but I do think it's something worthy enough to write down in your notebook.
Byron hates women. ?
Now, whatever Byron has been experiencing, or believes he's been experiencing, comes to a head at around noon on Thanksgiving Day, November 22nd, 2012, when two intruders break into Byron's home while he is in the basement. Two intruders, 18-year-old Haley Kiefer and her 17-year-old cousin Nick Brady, who were both shot and killed after they entered the home and made their way down the stairs to the basement. A break-in and shooting that Byron did not report until the following day.
Now, you told me at your residence today that your house had just been broken into. Can you tell me about that?
Okay. I had not gone to anyone for Thanksgiving. I am somewhat uncomfortable with other people's family holidays. Mm-hmm. Some people enjoy it, and it helps them feel home-like. I feel like a little out of place. It's not the kind of social thing I do.
Okay.
So I was staying at home, and just because there wasn't anything big happening, I was in the basement in my favorite reading chair reading a paperback.
Mm-hmm. Was this on Thanksgiving Day? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
This was this would have been about 12 o'clock, the exact time on the videotape. I mean, on the DVR.
So, I'm sorry, 12 o'clock noon on Thanksgiving Day, which was yesterday, correct? Okay. On Thursday.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I have to ask, Byron, after the shooting and it's done, why didn't you call law enforcement to report what happened? For the first couple hours, I was just shaking. And I gradually shifted into worrying about another accomplice. I mean, as far as I knew, the whole family was in on it. Bill and I thought the whole family was in on it. And I was pretty much afraid to do anything. An hour later, I had this screwball thought that seems sort of irrational now, but just because my Thanksgiving screwed up, I don't need to screw up yours.
Okay. Is that kind of why you didn't call law enforcement?
That was a part of it. And I was also sitting there thinking, it's all over. It's not going to change. I can wait till tomorrow in the daylight. I might be thinking more clearly. I saw it as a static situation.
Now, we've clipped parts of this interview to fit the chronological order of this timeline narrative we're laying out for you. And we wanted you to hear Byron's explanation for not calling the police until the following day at this point, so you could begin to experience for yourself how desensitized he is to this incident. He shot and killed a 17-year-old boy and an 18-year-old woman and described that situation as static. Basically meaning they weren't going to get any more dead, so why ruin a detective's Thanksgiving when this is something that could be handled tomorrow?
Yeah, it doesn't appear that he's remorseful at all. Let's say this was a justified shooting. These are teenagers. I mean, what about their families? What about, oh my God, I just shot and killed two young people in my home. Let me call somebody to help. And what about, I don't want to stay here with two dead bodies in my basement. The reasons for him waiting to call the following day clearly run far deeper than him not wanting to inconvenience the police. And as you'll soon learn, there's far more to this story than we have yet revealed.
Another reason we played this clip where we did is because Byron mentions the DVR in his home. Remember, this guy was in charge of security for the U.S. embassies a very long time, which meant, among other things, the installation of alarm systems, anti-bugging technology, and video and audio surveillance systems. So Byron had installed a fairly elaborate video surveillance system in his home and utilized an audio recording device to record audio of the entire break-in and the shooting. And unfortunately for his defense team, as you're about to hear, he recorded what happened after the shooting.
All of these recording systems would play a major role in Byron's trial because Byron and his defense team relied heavily on what is known as the Castle Doctrine. So as far as self-defense goes, Minnesota is not what is known as a stand-your-ground state. So residents there do have a duty to retreat before using deadly force. This means if you feel threatened, you must evade the confrontation if possible, and only use deadly force as a last resort if escape is indeed not possible. On the other hand, Minnesota does apply the Castle Doctrine when it comes to self-defense inside your home. This means that there is no duty to retreat if you feel threatened with great bodily injury or death in your own home, or you wish to prevent the commission of a felony inside your own home. But you do have to keep in mind the spirit of this doctrine. The purpose of using a firearm or deadly force is to stop a threat, not to intentionally kill an intruder just because they're an intruder. So you must stop shooting once the threat is removed, even if the intruder remains alive. If they are no longer in a position to seriously injure or kill you, you must stop shooting them. Let me say that one more time. You must stop shooting them.
And this is going to be important later as we unveil the rest of the story and more of Byron's statement to police. We have also clipped portions of the audio Byron recorded during the break-in and during and after the shooting. And with that, here comes our disclaimer. The details within the remaining portion of Byron's statement and the recording he made inside his home will increasingly grow more graphic as this episode continues. This was a man who, in spite of being an active victim of a break-in and intended burglary, committed very violent and horrific acts with zero remorse. His account and the real-time audio might be too disturbing for some listeners. So if you think you might be one of those listeners, we will take absolutely no offense to you ending this episode right here.
And please know that our use of these audio clips is not for shock value. Hearing them is the only way to truly get a sense of where Byron was mentally, and perhaps to understand why these two young lives were needlessly taken by him. And for me to say needlessly taken by him plays right into, despite the outcome of his trial, the controversy or debate that still lingers over this case today. Because this happened in Minnesota, and because these two teenagers actually broke into his home with the intent to commit a felony, and because he was home when this happened. Despite the spirit of the language within the Castle Doctrine and what you're about to hear in these recordings, there are still plenty of Minnesotans and residents of other states who believe what he did was perfectly justified. They believe that if someone breaks into your home while you're still there, all bets are off. That by breaking into that home, the burglars made themselves free game and there are no longer any rules or laws to protect them. Basically, they just walked into the purge.
Well, let's listen to what ultimately made a jury of his peers decide Byron Smith's actions were not protected by the Castle Doctrine. This clip starts off after Byron explains to the detective that he was simply sitting in his chair in the basement, enjoying a quiet Thanksgiving alone. What he hasn't told the detective, but the detective knows already because he watched a surveillance camera footage from the home for himself, is that prior to the break-in, Byron drove away in his vehicle so that anyone watching would think he was gone for the holiday. Then he snuck back into his home on foot. Take a listen.
The house is a very quiet house. It's got electric heat, and it's a very quiet house. And I hear someone rattling the upstairs door by the garage where everybody comes and goes. This is wrong. You shouldn't be rattling doorknobs without at least ringing the doorbell first. So I set down the book and I'm paying attention. And I see a shadow go past the picture window. And then somebody's rattling the basement door trying to get in. But it also is locked and deadbolted. And then I see the shadow in front of the picture window for maybe half a minute or a minute. Like they're trying to see what they can see inside. Okay, this is getting unhappy. And then the shadow leaves, and I hear somebody walking across the deck. And then somebody was rattling the upstairs door. And I'm getting seriously stressed because somebody wants in, and they're trying to sneak in, and it's happened before. So I'm sitting there hoping they go away. About a minute of silence, and I hear a glass window broken, which I later found to be the northwest corner bedroom window. So I'm sitting in the chair. Now, for the past month, my life has been very unhappy. I haven't slept very well. In fact, I'm lucky to get one good night of sleep a month. And I'm keeping everything locked up all the time because I'm being victimized again and again and again. And in the past couple of weeks, I've gotten into the habit of carrying my guns with me inside my house because I don't know who's going to break in when. So I'm sitting there and I hear the steps come down the hallway, turn around and come down the stairs. These are people who've stolen my guns. I figure they're willing to use guns if they steal guns. And I decide that I've got a choice of either shooting or being shot. And the guy came down the stairs and I shot him.
When they, you said you heard the window break upstairs, correct? Mm-hmm. You were downstairs. You heard footsteps down the hallway, right?
Yep.
So that would be from the bedroom, and then whoever... Somebody entered in your house through that broken window?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, that's how they made
it. Because it was easier than the deadbolted doors.
Okay.
And I replaced the panel that had been easy to kick out.
Okay.
So he just decided to break a window instead.
How many footsteps did you hear? Did it sound like one person, two people?
It was definitely one person.
Okay.
Definitely one person.
Okay.
And after I shot him, I sat down in his chair, and I was just tingling. Adrenaline. I hate adrenaline. And my blood was pounding in my ears, and I just wanted to calm down more than anything else. And maybe, it's hard to judge the time, 2 minutes, maybe 5 minutes, I was just sitting there with the blood pounding in my ears. And I hear more footsteps coming down the hallway. And somebody else starts down the stairs. Mm-hmm. And thinking back on it, what happened was everybody has red buttons. Everybody has sore spots. And I've known since grade school that being ganged up on is a sore spot with me. I just couldn't think. I didn't think. I wasn't thinking. I was just, they're ganging up on me. So I killed her too.
Okay.
Same way, except the first shot, she tumbled. And I walked over to finish her off. It was a new Mini 14 that I bought to replace the one that had been stolen. And it jammed, which is why I had the 22 with me. And it jammed. Trigger clicked and she laughed at me. I just pulled out the 22 and shot her and shot her.
Okay.
Then I sat down again, and I don't think I did anything else for an hour. And maybe 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, I spread the carpets over the blood.
Okay. When, what gun were you using at that time?
The Mini 14.
Okay. And you had that with you in the basement when you were sitting in your chair reading? Is that correct?
It was over by the stereo. Okay. When I heard the footsteps, I stepped up and it was maybe 5 or 8 steps away.
Okay. And then you said you also had a 22. Is that a revolver pistol? What kind of gun was that?
It's a revolver.
Okay. Is that how many shots is that?
It's a 9-shot.
Oh.
It's kind of strange.
Yeah.
But, I'd actually been wearing that inside the house somewhat regularly.
Okay. Were you wearing it at the time that incident happened, that break-in occurred?
Mm-hmm.
So you had it on your...
Yeah.
Where did you... You had it on your person, on your body, right?
Yeah.
Okay, where did you have it?
Right here.
Okay, you're pointing it right here. Are you referring to your...
belt loop.
Okay.
I mean, the brown leather holster has a belt loop.
Okay. So you had it on...
So it's really out of the way.
You had it on your belt... On your right side hip?
Yes.
That's what you were pointing, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it wasn't loaded when you had it?
Yes, it was.
Okay. You said you had used that 22 to shoot the female part, is that correct?
Yeah. I don't remember clearly whether the final shot to the man in the face was with that or not.
Okay.
I don't want to prolong the suffering. Even if I kill somebody, I don't want to leave a manslaughter.
Okay. Yeah.
In fact, with the female, after I dragged her out of the way, she was still doing some faint gasping, and I just right there.
You're saying right there, but you're pointing your finger underneath your chin?
The chin into the cranium.
Okay.
That 22 is a pea shooter. It doesn't go through bone very well.
Okay. With first off, we'll clarify with the male party.
Yeah.
So now you shoot twice with the Mini 14. You hit him in the hip area. Is that where you hit him?
Yeah.
Okay. He falls down to the bottom of the steps and he's on the floor, correct?
And he's looking face up at me.
Okay. Then what?
I shoot him in the face.
Okay.
I want him dead.
Mm-hmm. Where in the face did you shoot him? Do you remember?
I don't know exactly, somewhere near the center, and I didn't check afterwards.
Okay. Okay. And was that with the Mini 14 that you shot him in the face?
I think so.
Okay.
Now, at that point, there was a lot of blood, and I had a tarp laying by the fireplace that I was going to use to cover up the firewood.
Mm-hmm.
I pulled him on the tarp to keep so much blood from soaking into the carpet.
Okay. Well, so did you pull him over by away from the bottom of the steps over towards the fireplace?
No, I spread the tarp out and pulled him onto the tarp. I might have moved him 2 or 3 feet.
Okay.
Then I just wanted it out of my sight, and I dragged him around the corner into the shop.
Okay. In the shop area that's set up in the basement, correct?
Which is exactly where you found him.
Okay. Okay. And then you said, then when did the female party come in? Was this after this had happened?
Before I said 2 to 5 minutes later, and since I was just sitting there stunned, that's the best estimate I can give.
Sure.
2 to 5 minutes.
Okay. Then you said you were sitting there stunned after this had happened. Where were you sitting?
Same chair.
In the same chair. Okay. And then tell me what happened.
The rifle was sitting right alongside me at that time because I had just used it.
Okay. And you fired 3 rounds. Did you reload the gun?
Four.
Okay.
I'm not sure how many were in it. And then I reloaded it, yes.
Okay.
So the first shot, as she was coming down the stairs, as I recall, was again at about hip height. And she fell, and it repeated, except...
And did you hit her with that first shot? Do you remember?
I don't know. Okay. I was shaking pretty hard. I might have missed. I mean, it's what I would consider point-blank range, but I can't say for sure I hit her. She did tumble, though.
Was that after the first shot that she tumbled?
Yes.
Okay, so odds are you probably did hit her then.
Yeah. Or I might have just grazed her.
Okay. And again, you saw the feet first coming down the steps, correct, yes, from the chair, and then when it reached where you could see her hip area, that's when you fired, Chris. And obviously you didn't see her hands at that time, or if she had anything.
My thinking was, I'm not going to ask if there's a gun. You know, people who steal guns, I don't want to give them the chance to shoot me. She could have or might not have had a gun in her hands. And if there's one in the corner somewhere, or if it was inside her clothing or her purse, I didn't check.
Okay. So you shot, she came tumbling down the steps, and then you went to shoot again and the gun jammed. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, what happened after that, after the gun jammed?
After the gun jammed, well, he fell with his head under the table. She fell immediately at the bottom of the steps. So you'll see two different patches of blood on the floor.
Okay.
And when the gun clicked, misfired, she laughed at me. And
when she was laughing at you, she was at the bottom of the steps on the floor?
It wasn't a very long laugh because she was already hurting. But, you know, there was this smirk. And, okay, there's another red button I guess most people would have. It's not, if you're trying to shoot somebody and they laugh at you, you go again. I knew that the gun had misfired previously. Mm-hmm. And I just pulled it out, and yes, I fired more shots than I needed to.
Okay. She had basically enraged you for laughing at you, do you think? That was part of it?
No, that was incidental. She'd been, whoever it was who was breaking into my home had been doing it for so long that I was no longer willing to live in fear.
Right. Not to dwell back on it, Byron, but I almost got the story from with the female party. She had fallen to the ground. She laughed. She kind of had this laugh that you said she was when your gun misfired. And then you said you reached towards your hip and you had the .22 on your hip, right?
I was wearing the .22. I have been wearing it inside my house for the past several weeks.
Right. And that was loaded and it's a 9-shot. You said,
yes.
Correct. Okay. You pulled the .22. Where were you aiming? Do you recall?
Probably at her heart.
Okay.
And then she stopped moving.
Did the gun go off when you were aiming at her heart?
Yes. Maybe the chest area. I wasn't aiming that accurately.
Okay.
And I would guess there were about 4 shots.
Okay. Where did, with the .22 you're saying?
With the .22, yes.
Okay.
And she stopped moving. So I grabbed her by the clothing and dragged her over onto the tarp that was in the shop.
Okay.
That's where I left her.
When you shot her, you said 4 times. One was in the chest. Where were the other 3 rounds? Do you know?
In the upper chest.
Okay. Did you shoot her in the facial area or head area at all?
After she was on the tarp, she was still gasping.
Okay.
And as much as I hate someone, I don't believe they deserve pain. So I gave her a shot under the chin up into the cranium. I thought she was dead, and it turned out she wasn't.
Okay.
So I did a good, clean finishing shot.
Okay.
And she gave out the death twitch. First time I've ever seen it in a human, but it works the same in beaver and deer and whatever.
All right, let's go over a few things here to examine whether or not Byron's actions should have been protected by the Castle Doctrine. And then let's look into some things that might help identify his mental state at the time of the shooting. He said he shot Nick in the hip area as soon as that part of his body revealed itself at the foot of the stairs. And he said Nick fell down the stairs and onto the floor. From there, it seems pretty evident that any threat Nick posed to Byron was over. He was injured, unarmed, and Byron was still holding his gun. Then Byron walked up to the teenager and finished him off with a shot to Nick's face. He didn't stop shooting once it was clear there was no more threat. So that, to me, seems to exceed any protection for Byron under the Castle Doctrine.
Correct. And then after he pulls Nick's dead body onto the tarp and secures him in the workshop, he says he hears someone else walking toward the basement stairs 2 to 5 minutes later. I believe, according to the surveillance camera footage, it was more like 8 to 10 minutes. But either way, he has an opportunity, after several minutes to calm down, to scream at the other person that he has a gun and they need to either announce themselves and their intentions or leave. And I say to either announce themselves and their intentions because what if those footsteps are coming from a cop who's there responding to a report of gunshots? Or even a concerned neighbor like his buddy Bill? But this never seems to enter his mind. He chooses instead to lie in wait, ambush style, like he did Nick, and as soon as enough of Haley's lower body presents itself, he shoots her.
Andy says after she was shot and tumbled down the stairs, she smiled at him, as if to ridicule him. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that did not happen. And I think it speaks to what you alluded to earlier about him having some sort of issue with women. And you'll hear more evidence of that in the final clip from the recording that he made during and after the shooting.
And ultimately, to close this argument about the Castle Doctrine, Byron tells the detective, yes, I fired more shots than I needed to. And he finished her off by putting the revolver under her chin and pulled the trigger. And to further demonstrate how desensitized he was to what he was actually doing, he says, and she gave out a death twitch. It was the first time I'd seen it in a human, but it works the same with beaver, deer, and whatever. He put no more thought into doing that than if he was putting down a wild animal. And you're going to hear more of that in the recording he made in his home. So let's prepare you for that.
We've clipped the recording because it's very lengthy, but we kept the parts we believe are important in demonstrating Byron's state of mind. We also left out most of the disturbing parts where you can hear Nick and Haley struggling to survive.
But we did choose to start this clip at the final gunshot that ends Haley's life so you can hear what he says immediately after. You'll also hear Byron throughout the clip rehearsing a phone call to a lawyer's office, a call that he never makes. Instead, he waits the following day to seek help from his friend Bill, who in turn called police. This clip is just over 10 minutes long.
Of course, I'm safe now. Cute. I'm sure she thought she was a real pro. No rush, but, you know, roll when it's convenient for you. I feel a little bit safer. I'm totally safe. I'm still shaking a bit, but a little bit safer. No rush, but, you know, as convenient for you. I left my house at 11:30. They were both dead by 1. I refused to live in fear. I felt like I was cleaning up a mess. Worse than spilled food. Worse than vomit. Worse than shit. Cleaning up a mess. There was a major complication in my life. You really don't want to know. Please, man, you don't want to know. I am not bleeding hard, my brother. I felt like I was cleaning up a mess. Not like spilled food. Not like vomit. Not even like diarrhea. It's the worst mess possible. And I was stuck with it.
Mother and
father are semi-psychotic, are both semi-psychotic. I put even odds that one or the other will come for you with a gun. I received a death threat. I recorded it. You'll get a copy of it. I get a death threat, you'll get a copy of it. If I give you a copy of a death threat, I expect you to do something about it.
Given all the derogatory comments about Haley, I think it's clear that our assumption about him having an issue with women is pretty spot on.
And I think what we discussed at the beginning of the episode about how prolonged exposure in a high-stress, threatening environment can affect a person might help explain, at least somewhat, what was going on with Byron up to this point. He was clearly paranoid and basically believed that an attack was always pending. And in some lesser way, he was right. Haley and Nick did break in to burglarize his home, but clearly they were no threat to his well-being or his life. They thought he was gone because he staged it that way. People that want to harm you break into your home when they believe you're home.
Yeah, I mean, he drove his car away, snuck back in on foot, and then sat in his basement, armed to the teeth to ambush and kill whoever or whatever dared to enter. This was his plan, and in his mind, it was justified, and there'd be no repercussions for carrying it out. He was protecting his home from intruders, just like he protected his country from terrorist threats for all those years. This was his training, and he was in all-out protection mode. Now, I'm not a psychologist, but it would seem as though he had some clear damage from his experience with the State Department.
And I think it's pretty likely he had some pre-existing issues even before that job. I mean, he had this issue with women and some other things. And you would think that if there was something obviously wrong with this dude that really stuck out, that they would have caught it when he applied for this position at the State Department, because they do go through a vigorous background investigation and medical review. But I will say this, the background investigations for those positions are primarily focused on how vulnerable the candidate might be to turning a spy for a foreign government. So who knows? All we can say is that he went into Thanksgiving that day with the intention of enticing someone to break into his home so he could kill them. And that's exactly what he did.
And for that, he would pay the price for his crimes. On April 29th, 2014, the jury returned with their verdict following 3 hours of deliberation. They found Byron David Smith guilty on 2 counts of first-degree murder with premeditation and on 2 counts of second-degree murder. He was sentenced to 2 life sentences without the possibility of parole. In March of 2021, his final appeal was denied.
If you'd like to learn more about this case, check out the show notes for this episode on our website, investigatorspodcast.com.
Until next week, take care and take care of each other.
And remember, a person's home is their castle. And yes, you have the right to protect it, but don't protect it like it's still the Middle Ages. Because if you do, you might have to deal with us. Because we're the investigators!
I came from the mud, there's dirt on my hands. Strong like a tree, there's roots where I stand. Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon. Catch me howling at the moon.
Mental illness affects millions of people worldwide. If you or someone you know is suffering from a mental illness, you're not alone, and there are resources available. Visit NAMI.org. That's NAMI.org to find resources in your area.